Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up on this edition. We're going to talk about some of the world's biggest companies, the likes of TikTok and Nvidia. And we'll also be looking ahead to President Trump's green policies. What will they be? But we're going to spend most of the programme talking about Syria and how it may now attempt to rebuild its economy. Cafes, markets and bakeries are slowly reopening. But what sort of country will emerge following the overthrow of President Assad's government? Questions that we will try and answer on the programme. But before we get there, let's find out more about the country and its economy from our very own Stefania Goza.
Today, the Syrian economy is only a seventh part of what it was in 2011, the year the Syrian revolution started. It came after a wave of protests and uprisings known as the Arab Spring spread across much of the Arab world, deposing leaders in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt and Yemen. But in Syria, protests against President Bashar al-Assad evolved into a long conflict that over a decade saw the emergence of rebel groups like the Free Syrian Army and the incursion of new players like the so-called Islamic State. Chaos and fighting have pushed 14 million people out of the country, making Syria the world's largest refugee crisis, according to the United Nations. In this time, living conditions have deteriorated within the country. 70% of the population is in need of humanitarian assistance and 90% live below the poverty line. Agriculture and oil used to be the pillars of the Syrian economy before the war, but the government lost control of most of its oil fields to rebel groups, and fighting and international economic sanctions have shrunk exports of grain and cotton. In recent times, the regime had bet on riskier industries to finance the war, like the trade of a cheap amphetamine called Captagon, of which Syria is now the largest producer in the world.
The news of President Assad's overthrow has seen Syrians celebrating across the world, as we heard from Stefania. Many of them had fled the country. Let's hear from one in London.
My name is Mohammed Haitham Yasir. The worst occupation is when you are occupied by your own people. We waited 54 years to get rid of this tyrant. At least give us 50 days to get ourselves together. It will be better, 100%.
During President Assad's regime, many Syrians lost their business. Let's hear from one. Hadi Nouri, she ran a travel agency. She lost it and then came here and settled in the UK. She's been speaking to my colleague, Sam Fennick.
My travel agency was in that area next to Damascus. It's fully destroyed. My office fully destroyed and stolen. So that's put me in suffering about losing my money, my kids' future, everything I've done for about 10 years working in this office destroyed in front of my eyes.
So now when you look at what's happening, would you consider going back home?
Yeah, of course. Now we need to support our family, support the country. We need to rebuild free Syrian again. I want to give as much as I can to support my country, Syria.
Let's get a sense of the scale of the task ahead when it comes to rebuilding that economy. Last week here on the programme, we spoke to a Syrian economist, Arif Alkrez. He's from Aleppo. He's now based in Italy. We wanted to go back to him and get his thoughts now that things have changed.
It's a historical moment for everyone. They started to celebrate. They started to breathe freedom a bit. People are really happy, celebrating everywhere. The first day, yesterday in Damascus, for example, the situation was a bit worrying for the people, so not a lot of people went out to the street. A lot of shops were closed. As of this morning, everywhere it was open.
There are, of course, big political questions that need to be answered about who's going to fill the leadership gap in Syria. But we want to talk about the economy with you. And this is a country's economy that between 2010 and 2021, the GDP shrank by 54%. How do you rebuild that economy?
For us as Syrians now, post-Assad, Syria economy would face a long and complex journey toward recovery. Rebuilding Syria will take decades. Assad have left Syria in a crippled economy status. I wish the sanction will be lifted since now regime is gone, because it's going to affect the economy so badly. We need the international trade. We need the banking system. We need the foreign investment for Syria. It's going to be a huge amount of money. Let's give you an example. The oil sector in Syria have damaged for more than $100 billion. This number was estimated by the Assad government last year. For the oil sector to run now, we need a lot of fixing and rehabilitation for the oil fields.
It's difficult to get figures of what's been going on in Syria. But as of 2022, there were some figures that said poverty affected 69% of the population. Around 14.5 million Syrians were living in poverty. Can you give us an example of what people's lives have been like economically under President Assad?
Really, really bad. People were living in the dark. It was no electricity. It was no water system running. It was a lot of difficulties. The hyperinflation have left a lot of people in really critical situation. They cannot even afford the daily needed, for example, bread, getting water. The Syrians have suffered so much.
We got a sense there of some of the money that Syria is going to need to get back on its feet. Some estimates say it could be at least $400 billion to just get that economy going again. So where is that money going to come from? A question for Robert Ford, the former U.S. ambassador to Syria.
The good news is they don't need the $400 billion or whatever the figure is right away. I mean, it's over a period of time. They will get some funding from organizations like the World Bank, probably currency and trade balance support from the IMF. Then they would also seek funding from different Arab Gulf states and Arab Gulf financial institutions. Kuwait, for example, has a large economic assistance fund. They'll look to the European Union. They'll look to the British. They'll look to the Americans. They'll look to the Canadians. And it's going to be hard. I cannot overstate how hard this will be.
And is it a lot harder nowadays? You also know Iraq very well. You were an ambassador there. But when they were trying to rebuild their country, and there is still a lot of work that needs to be done there, they were doing it in an era where interest rates were a lot lower than they are now.
And Iraq had the advantage of a steady stream of oil revenues, which over time went up and went up farther. So the Syrians won't have that. Their oil assets are tiny and already badly damaged from fighting in the civil war. So it's going to be very hard. I would expect that the first thing that the Syrian technical people will want to do is figure out what to do about basic things like infrastructure.
Getting that money is also difficult when people are not sure of politically how the country is going to develop. Germany and France have said in the last hour that they will cooperate with the new Syrian government. You can't have economic stability without political stability, can you?
Not only can you not have economic stability without political stability, but you can't have it without security stability. And it was a constant problem during the American-led efforts for Iraqi reconstruction. We had many conferences during my time in Iraq, bringing international partners together with the Iraqis for pledging sessions for grants and loans for rebuilding, but never took off very well because of the constant security problems on the ground. And I think that will be the very first question in Syria. How safe will it be, for example, foreign technical experts to go and look at water systems, to go and look at the electricity systems and the gas lines and the refineries and such things?
And that safety is important as well, because we've had a huge exodus from the country. If it wants to develop economically, it needs some of those best, bright minds to come back. And they won't come back if they think the country is not safe.
They won't. The good news is, I mean, the Assad government has only been gone for 2 days, but there's already been a big flow of Syrian refugees from Turkey, where there were 4 million Syrian refugees, a big flow in the last 36 hours of people going back to their homes in Aleppo, in Homs. I think it will be possible to attract many Syrians, reverse brain drain, if you will, if there is security and if, in a sense, the government allows people to use their talents. Listeners should remember that Syria was a heavily state-dominated economy in a very old-fashioned Arab socialist nationalist system.
You know Iraq well. How would you compare the task of rebuilding Syria to the task of rebuilding Iraq?
Bigger, much bigger, because the damage from the Iraq civil war was quite bad. But what has happened to Syria would be like the destruction in places like Mosul, Ramadi, and Fallujah. But almost every single Syrian city has suffered that kind of damage. The only city that really has escaped is central Damascus. The suburbs of Damascus also, in many places, were leveled. Same with central Homs, third largest city, as well as its suburbs. And out in the east, serious damage from fighting, places like Raqqa. But I think listeners should not get too pessimistic a view. Syrians actually have a lot of terrific talents. They're very entrepreneurial. We see that with refugee communities in places like Turkey. And frankly, here in the United States, there's a very big Syrian professional class. There are many, many hundreds and hundreds of Syrian medical doctors here. Some of them have been, for the last several years, operating hospitals and clinics in northern Syria, where the Syrian army was not present, and so American citizens could work safely. So there are a lot of talents, and if we can put it all together, it could work. It would only work gradually, of course.
Fascinating to hear the former ambassador to Syria there from the U.S. Peter Jankowski is vice president, research and analysis at Apple Financial Services. Chicago is with us, Peter. I think another example there, though, of the fact that we don't live in this era of cheap money anymore, interest rates much higher than they used to be, that makes it difficult for companies, but also countries as well.
Indeed, it does. And, obviously, much of the talk was about how long this would take. And of course, the higher interest rates exact an even larger toll in that case. So that will be a part of the challenge. But I think the primary challenge is still the security of the country and providing that stability that will help attract capital.
Peter, stay with us. China has launched a competition investigation into NVIDIA, the world's most valuable maker of computer chips. We often talk to Peter about that on this program. Let's speak to our tech correspondent, Lily Jamali. This is could be a problem for NVIDIA because they have quite a lot of their market in China, don't they?
Yeah, we're seeing NVIDIA shares taking a hit on this news that China's going after them on anti-monopoly grounds. It's an investigation for now, but the State Administration for Market Regulation there said the company is suspected of violating commitments that it made in a recent acquisition of an Israeli firm, a chip designer based in Israel. So the background here, as you know, is that NVIDIA is at the center of this proxy war of sorts between the U.S. and China. And the powerful AI chips that NVIDIA designs are in demand pretty much everywhere, very much on both sides of the Pacific. And so the U.S. and China both trying to dominate AI, and they both need to corner the market on these high-end chips, which are one of the main ingredients. So last week, we saw Washington tightening restrictions on sales to almost 150 foreign companies. A few Chinese chip firms were on that list. They will now need special permission to make purchases. And then we saw China responding right away after that announcement, cracking down on sales of certain key minerals to the U.S. So things are tense. And there is a definite tit-for-tat aspect to all of this.
Stay with us, Lily. I want to bring Peter back in here. As Lily said there, it has affected NVIDIA's share price. And that has been one of the real drivers of the U.S. stock exchange, hasn't it? The AI side of things. If that all gets caught up in a trade war between China and the U.S., the markets aren't going to like that, are they?
Well, I think generally they're not going to like that period in terms of the impact across the broad market. In the case of NVIDIA, it was down about 2.5% today. It's hard to say how much of that was the Chinese story, how much of it just was maybe general concerns about interest rates. because there have been some talk of, you know, we have an inflation report coming out, the Fed meeting next week. That probably has a bigger impact on NVIDIA long term than the China news.
Stay with us, Peter. Lily, let's go back to you on that Chinese theme, because the social media company TikTok and its owner ByteDance have asked a US court to pause the ban on the app due to come in next month. This could be quite significant, couldn't it?
It certainly could. They want TikTok and ByteDance to want to stop, you know, the app from going dark, you know, becoming unavailable here in the U.S. next month after that very big loss handed to them by the U.S. Appeals Court on Friday. So they filed this legal request basically to block that decision from taking effect so that the Supreme Court can have time to weigh in. And, you know, both sides of this, both the government and TikTok and the creators that are also a part of the suit, actually asked the appeals court to weigh in by December 6th, which was that Friday, so they could have time for this to make its way to the Supreme Court with plenty of time. The Department of Justice is saying the arguments that TikTok and ByteDance made have been heard and they've been definitively rejected. But we're hearing from TikTok creators today that are really concerned. Talia Cadet is one who's actually a party to the lawsuit here. She lives in Washington, D.C., in the area there, and has almost 150,000 TikTok followers who look to her for lifestyle tips, for travel tips. And here's what she told me when we spoke earlier today.
Even a temporary disruption is devastating to creators like myself, creators who make their livelihoods and feed their families using the income they generate from TikTok. It's devastating to small business owners who market their business.
Lily, we're going to have a new president from the 20th of January. Could he have a different view when it comes to TikTok and ByteDance?
Absolutely. We know he has a different view on this divest or ban law. This was something that was passed in the spring by the U.S. Congress and quickly signed into law by President Joe Biden. Donald Trump has been very open about how he doesn't agree with the law and wants to do something about it. I think that's been part of his appeal to a certain subset of Americans. There's 170 American TikTok users. The question is, can he do it? What levers can he pull to make that happen? How might he influence his Department of Justice when he takes office? And what are some of the other things to consider? Because you also have to remember that Apple and Google, who run the app stores where people get TikTok and download it to their phones, they are also really important players in this story. If they don't have very strong assurances that they are protected, if they keep offering the app on those app stores, they are putting themselves in, you know, a legally precarious position. We don't know what they're going to do. They haven't been very vocal about that. But it's something where, you know, even assurances from the president might not be enough to assuage their concerns.
Lily, thanks for joining us. Peter, another sign there of how the business environment has changed. TikTok, really important core to some businesses in getting customers.
Indeed. You know, there are a number of influencers out there, obviously, who are making their direct living from it. But brands increasingly go out to those influencers, obviously, to draw customers into their products. So there certainly could be a spillover effect well beyond the immediate influencers who are talking about their losses currently.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's talk now about the biggest contract awarded in the history of sport, which has led to headlines like this in the US.
You ask me, like, top of head based on precedent, Juan Soto signs a 14-year, $650 million contract.
He's going to get something that starts with a 7, if not an 8. Not a 5 or a 6, but a 7.
It's worth it. Need to get my money.
As you heard, there has gone to the baseball player Juan Soto, who has agreed a $765 million deal over 15 years with Major League Baseball's New York Mets. Tim Britton is a senior writer at The Athletic who covers the New York Mets.
Yeah, well, Juan Soto has been kind of a revelation since he entered Major League Baseball at the age of 19. You know, he's a remarkable hitter who combines power and a keen eye in the batter's box. That's really his chief skill and one that ages well for superstar baseball players. And then last year with the Yankees, he had the best season of his career, set a career high in home runs. you know, hit the home run that clinched the pennant for them to send them to the World Series. You know, really as good a free agent as there has been in Major League Baseball in almost a quarter century, basically. So that's why the bidding went as high as it did for Soto.
Okay, it went high. How high? Explain how much money he's going to get, where that puts him in baseball rankings of pay and sport rankings of pay.
The previous record was set just last year by Shohei Ohtani when he signed with the Los Angeles Dodgers. Ohtani's deal was for 10 years and ostensibly $700 million, but it was heavily deferred. He's actually getting most of that money 10 years down the road. So it really, in present day terms, was only worth about $460 million. So Soto's deal really smashes that record by more than $300 million. So it's a remarkable level. He pushed the highest salary anyone's earning in Major League Baseball by 10%. So it's a big jump. Bigger than I think most anyone expected, but it's still a remarkable number when you think about it.
More from Tim in a minute, but we wanted to take you to the Dominican Republic, as that is where Juan Soto is from. So how popular is baseball there? A question for Sam Lubo, former baseball scout and currently the president of the Dominican Baseball Camp. He spoke to us from the small mountain town of Jarabaco.
It's a small island, but it is producing the most major leaguers per capita in the world. And there's such a passion for the game. They don't miss on good athletes. All the best young athletes are playing baseball. So whereas in the United States, we might have a good young athlete who chooses basketball or American football or soccer or some other sport, almost every good young male athlete is going to be playing baseball in the Dominican Republic.
If I went for a walk around, is that what I would see? Everybody playing baseball there?
If you went for a walk, you wouldn't have to go more than a few blocks to see either little kids in the street hitting bottle cap with stick or some baseball field. Every little kid has a baseball field within walking distance of his house. And that's contrasted to what's happened in the United States now, where they're getting in the minivan and playing travel baseball and going over to the next town or whatever. So that's it's everywhere.
Is that the environment that then creates a Juan Soto who becomes the world's highest paid sports star?
Yeah, the kids will start at as young as 12 years old to basically committing their life to baseball. They'll go and join academies where they're training and hoping to sign a contract, which they can sign at 16. And so they focus a lot. They've taken a lot more reps, a lot more repetitions compared to even an American kid of that same age. There's no secret that there's a lot of good baseball players here. Every major league team has probably at least five scouts on the island, and they're regularly having big showcase events.
He's obviously a big star in the US. He's a big star in the Dominican Republic as well. Are there lots of conversations about him? You deal with lots of kids. Is he a big role model now?
We'll go to local baseball fields and do clinics for little kids. And a question we'll often ask is, who's your favorite baseball player? And his name is definitely one that comes up probably as much as any at this point.
When you have a sports star who signs a 15-year deal, which is a long deal in sports for $765 million, you've already painted a wonderful picture of a place which is in love with baseball. That's going to increase the love of baseball, isn't it? A lot of parents will be saying, hey, I'd like my kid to be the next successful star from the Dominican Republic.
There are fewer other options. And so when people see the amount of money that's going into baseball, it does motivate and incentivize young people to pursue that.
Are they hungrier than American kids, do you think?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. In general, I think so. I think they have fewer other alternatives. And I think that they have a tougher lifestyle to begin with. And that translates on the baseball field.
So how come there's so much money in Major Baseball at the moment that you can pay someone so much cash? Here's Tim Britton from The Athletic once again.
The thing that separates baseball from the other sports in North America is lack of a salary cap. And so in baseball, you know, you are not capped at the top end in what you can spend on your roster, unlike the NFL or the NBA or NHL. And so superstar players like Soto and Ohtani can really push the market beyond what they can in other sports. And the Mets are owned by Steve Cohen. He's a hedge fund manager who is baseball's richest owner with a net worth that's estimated above $20 billion. And so, you know, there's been a lot of people who wonder about the future of baseball as fan base ages, but the revenue streams for baseball have been going up consistently. You've got owners like Cohen, like Guggenheim Partners out in Los Angeles with the world champion Dodgers, who are willing to spend on their roster to win. And this is the result of that.
When you think of baseball in New York, I'm afraid to say the Mets probably don't come into your mind as much as the New York Yankees. So why have they spent so much money?
for any Mets fan, that they've always grown up in the shadow of the Yankees. You know, the Mets were kind of the replacement for the Dodgers and the Giants when those teams moved west in the late 1950s. The Yankees have been a far more successful franchise. Over the time the two teams have shared the city, the Mets have not won a World Series in 38 seasons. The Yankees have won several since then. And so for the Mets to sign away a player, not just for them to land a player like Soto, that would be huge regardless, but to sign him away from the Yankees where Soto spent last season, when the Yankees still wanted him, when he's still in his prime as a player, something that was really unfathomable for the Mets in the pretty recent past. Before Cohen owned them, Mets were known for pinching their pennies, for not spending much on their payroll, and for being cheaper than they probably should have been in the New York market. They kind of learned their lesson in who to spend that money on after spending it on some older players and not succeeding. So they decided to take the risk with Soto because he's so young.
Tim Britton, the Peter Jankowskis, still with it. It's an extraordinary sum of money, isn't it? Are you a baseball fan? Is it, how popular is baseball around you, Peter?
Well, in the Chicago area, we're known for the Cubs and the White Sox, which is largely a record of futility. certainly there are people that are very passionate about it. I grew up on the West Coast with the Dodgers, watching them, and it is an enjoyable sport. It's just hard to imagine that much money for a single player.
It really is. Peter, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Some news coming in now. The New York Times is reporting that a court in the U.S. city of Nevada has denied Rupert Murdoch his bid to give control of his media empire to his eldest son. We'll get more on that story, and we will continue our coverage of the Syrian economy on Business Matters in a couple of hours' time.